Please take your Bibles once again and turn to the book of Colossians. Colossians 2 and the verses that we read just moments ago. Colossians 2, verses 16 through 23, 16 to the end of the chapter. In my mind, one of the greatest inventions of the last 20 or 30 years, whatever it's been, 25 years, one of the greatest inventions of all is the spam folder and the spam filter. I am ever so grateful for the way it filters out each morning and each day all of those silly, all of those unwanted emails that come into my box and takes care of that for me, or at least much of that for me. Now, while I joke about this, of course, I need to be careful and recognize the tragic side of all of that spam email that comes at us. The tragic side being the many people, we've all heard stories of people who've been trapped by that and taken in by that, heard stories of people who have entered into and responded to some sort of email by making what they thought was a wise investment in something, and as a result have lost and been cheated of everything. And that's really my introductory point this morning. The tragic consequences of being cheated. The tragic consequences of being cheated. Waking up in the end and finding you've lost everything and been cheated of everything. I make those comments because in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 through 23, those verses that we're looking at this morning, Paul warns us of scams. He warns us of scams. He warns his Colossian readers and warns us of scams that can come to us as believers. Not scams that affect and take away earthly fortune and earthly treasure, but scams, if you will, that are infinitely greater and infinitely more precarious and serious, for they have eternal consequences, not merely temporal consequences. The passage before us breaks down in a very simple way. It almost outlines itself for us this morning. For he really Paul warns us of three scams, as I'm calling them this morning. Three ways that we can be cheated. In fact, in my New King James, you may have noted that he actually uses that word, cheat you. Let no one cheat you. And that's why I'm referring to it and introducing it in the manner I am this morning. He talks about three scams, as it were. But each one, as he breaks it down, each one he introduces by a warning to us, a warning to the Colossian readers, and a warning to us. In verse 16, at the beginning of verse 16, he gives a warning. So let no one judge you in food or in drink, etc. And he goes on there. In verse 18, the next one, in verse 18, let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility. And he goes on from there. And then finally, in verse 20, therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations? Don't subject yourselves to regulations, he says there, and goes on from there. So these are the three scams, each one of them introduced by a warning. Don't let somebody judge you in this. Don't let somebody cheat you in this. Why are you doing this, he says. And introduces by those three warnings these three scams, as I keep putting it, that we want to take a look at this morning. Three potential scams, three traps that are out there, not only in the first century for the Colossian readers, but are out there for us, very much so today. So let's take a look at this text before us this morning. Let's start in verses 16 and 17 with the first scam that is presented. And I've called this in your outline, if you follow along there, not shadows. Indeed, at the beginning of the message, right at the title of the message, take note of that, Christ plus what? Christ plus nothing. And so the first thing we see is Christ plus, not shadows, not shadows. So this reference to shadows that I have will be coming up in the text as we take a look at it in just a few minutes. But let's begin with the warning, as I say, that comes in verse 16. So let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths. As I've said before, probably you're getting tired of me saying this, but we don't fully understand exactly what the Colossian false teaching is. The false teaching that's going on in the Colossian church that they're hearing about and that Paul is warning them of in this epistle. Each epistle has a purpose and it speaks into a particular occasion. The occasion of the letter to the Colossian church is false teaching that's going on there. The difficulty we have is identifying exactly what that false teaching is and was. However, nevertheless, we can understand very clearly Paul's instructions. So it's not problematic for us, it's just that we can't firmly get a precise handle on what is being taught. But as I've also said repeatedly, we get some clues as to what that false teaching is, what the heresy is that's coming at the Colossians. In fact, those clues are most prevalent in these verses that we're reading this morning, and just before it and just after it, but primarily in these verses that we're reading this morning. So as a result, here in verse 16, we see this warning that comes to them regarding a number of things, a number of specifics, and this is one clue as to the false teaching. Paul warns them of food, lest somebody judge you in food or in drink, or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths. All of these things would seem to be reference to the Old Testament and to the law. All of these things, regulations regarding food, regulations regarding drink. There are much more regarding food than there are concerning drink, but there are laws and warnings concerning drink in the Old Testament. Also, of course, the festivals. All of these are referenced in your outline. We're not going to take time to look them up, but you can look them up later and see that indeed this is true. All of these things that Paul is warning them of, or warning about people who will judge them concerning these things, all of these things are spoken of in the law in the Old Testament. I've already mentioned food and drink. Festivals, of course, in Leviticus 23. Also, the Sabbath. Paul says, don't be judged by people concerning the Sabbath and your keeping of the Sabbath. So we see, and also new moons are in there as well. And they're also mentioned in the Old Testament. They would mark the beginning of a month by the new moon in the Old Testament. So all of these things refer to aspects of Old Testament Judaism and the law in the Old Testament. So we see here there's some aspect of this false teaching that pertains to Old Testament Judaism, or perhaps a perversion of Old Testament Judaism. And it's coming at the Colossians and being taught as part of this false teaching coming at the Colossians. Some sort of aspects of the law, and more specifically, as these all are, aspects of what we would call the ceremonial law, festivals, things you can and can't eat, new moons, Sabbaths, all aspects of what we would call the ceremonial law. In other words, it would seem somehow that part of this false teaching is Christ plus the ceremonial law. Christ plus the ceremonial law. And these false teachers are judging them in accordance with how much they are adhering to and their usage of these aspects of the ceremonial law. So let's move on to what Paul's response and Paul's instruction is to them regarding this sort of false teaching that's coming at them. This first scam, if you will, as I put it earlier. Paul says quite succinctly, no, 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 no. Paul says, to elaborate on that answer, Paul says, verse 17, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ. That's a weighty statement. He says these things are shadows. The substance is of Christ, he says. Paul says no because that is not the intent of these aspects of the ceremonial law. They are not the substance. The substance is Christ. Instead, they are shadows intended to point you to Christ. And Christ is the substance. So Paul says, no, no, no. You need to understand why those ceremonial aspects of the law were given. They were shadows to point to Christ. We have some friends in the Lower Mainland, some good friends back in the Lower Mainland. And a few years ago, these particular friends went to their annual Christmas party, the company Christmas party. And that's a common thing that comes up in these coming weeks, isn't it? And so this year, it'd be about, good 5 years ago now, I think it was, they went to their company Christmas party. And it just so happened at that party, they won, as is common at these parties, they give out prizes, door prizes, get a little ticket and whatnot. And they won the big prize of the evening. They won, I think it was about a 50-inch flat-screen TV that evening. Now, my friends did not do what I'm about to say. Please hear me. But suppose they did. Suppose they did the following. What would you think of them? Suppose, as it came time to hand in their ticket and get their flat-screen TV at the end of the evening, they said, you know what? Over the course of the evening, I've kind of become attached to this ticket. And I look down at this ticket, and it's got this beautiful Christmas red and green font on it. And it's quite beautiful, in fact. And so, if you don't mind, I'm going to say no to the TV, and I'm just going to hang on to this ticket, because it's such a wonderful ticket. And we're laughing, and you're supposed to laugh at that, because that would be crazy. It would be nonsense. No one would do that. Or perhaps, let's consider another possible account, hypothetical account. Suppose you're visiting Paris with a friend, with your spouse, whomever, and you're going to see the Eiffel Tower. You're going to the Eiffel Tower, and it starts to emerge in front of you, and your spouse or your friend, whoever it is you're traveling with, turns to you and says, look at that. Isn't that amazing? Look at the height of it. Look at the ironwork. Look at this amazing structure before us. And they turn to say this to you, and they find you're looking at the ground, and you're saying, yeah, the shadow of it just shows that wonderfully there on the ground. I can see it all. I can see that wonderful ironwork. I can see how big it is. Again, you would say to your friend, you've lost it. You're crazy. You're nuts. The Old Testament ceremonial law was intended to teach us, was intended to point us to the substance, point us to Christ. It is but a shadow. It is not the substance. Christ is the substance. Christ fulfills the Old Testament scriptures. Not only the ceremonial law, but the Old Testament scriptures. And thus, and here we go, folks, Christ is sufficient. Christ is all sufficient. Not Christ plus the ceremonial law. And for us today, let's expand it a little bit. Not Christ plus some sort of ritual. Not Christ plus any sort of ritual. But Christ plus nothing. Christ and Christ alone. Let's move on to the second scam. The second warning, the second instruction, the second scam. We've seen not Christ plus shadows, Christ plus nothing. And the second one is not Christ plus higher knowledge, not Christ plus higher knowledge or a deeper experience also. Rather, Christ plus nothing. Where do we see this? In verse 18 and 19. Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind, and then he goes on from there. We'll touch on verse 19 in a moment. There are a lot of difficulties even in translating these verses here. I've said repeatedly the difficulty we have in pinpointing precisely what the false teaching is. And part of the problem is even the translation of some of the words is difficult. In fact, if you're reading an ESV this morning or some other version, you may find what I'm reading in my New King James to be somewhat different from the ESV. And I'll touch on those in a second. So even the translation of these couple of verses, especially here, is rather difficult. But nevertheless, there are some general features which I think help steer us along in very much the right direction. Let's take a look at some of the general features he speaks of here in verse 18. He speaks of false humility. The ESV translates that as asceticism. Asceticism. We're going to touch on that, do more than touch on it later on, because Paul's going to circle back to that towards the end of our time together this morning. Asceticism being great and severe and extreme self-discipline. Self-discipline taken to a great extreme. And that's how the ESV translates what the New King James translates, false humility. But asceticism is something we'll come back to later on. Let's look at the other things that are present here, first of all, in verse 18. The other things he speaks of are worship of angels, and also he speaks about these false teachers who are intruding into those things which he has not seen. Again, the ESV translates this quite differently. The ESV says, going into details about visions. Going into details about visions. So it may be that these false teachers are talking about the worship of angels, they're talking about visions that they're having. And then the last feature of this verse 18 even is that they are vainly, these are still the false teachers, are vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. By his fleshly mind. So we've got angel worship, we've got visions, we've got puffed up minds. And though we grapple with this somewhat and are unclear exactly on things, what this seems to be pointing to, and I mentioned this a number of weeks ago, and this comes up when we are studying, inevitably, when we're studying the book of Colossians, it seems to me that although we don't precisely know, this is suggesting an early form of what would later develop, about 100 years later, later develop into a heresy called Gnosticism. Now, we're not going to go into great details this morning about Gnosticism, and for that, you may be thankful. But rather, I do need you to understand one critical point, the main feature of this, and see with me, does it not match up somewhat with what we're reading here in verse 18? One of the key features of Gnosticism, indeed, it's in the actual name of it. That's taken from the Greek word, Gnosticism is taken from the Greek word for knowledge. And that gives you a very important clue, and as I say, to the one point that we want to make this morning about Gnosticism, the one thing you need to know is that it placed great value on the pursuit of a higher knowledge, a higher mystical knowledge that was only available to a select few, perhaps. Now, this is likely not Gnosticism that we're talking about here, but it may very well be, and many think it is, an earlier form of it. It's the soil from which Gnosticism may have burst forth in time, because it has this feature, does it not? As I describe later Gnosticism and its valuing of a higher mystical knowledge available only to a select few, and then we read this verse that talks about the worship of angels, of visions, of puffed up, proud minds. Does that not seem to mesh with what I was talking about earlier? So that would seem to be some part of the false teaching that's going on there, this sort of early form of that Gnosticism that values this mystical knowledge. But not only in the first century, not only in the second century in its full-blown form, but we face this even today, forms of this. It may not be called this, but it's the same thing today. And it challenges the believer today. And we need to be on guard. We need to be wary of this scam that comes at us. We need to have those spam filters on in our email boxes, as it were. And I'm talking metaphorically there, of course. These individuals were pursuing that higher knowledge, that deeper experience, and we have that with us today. A higher knowledge, a deeper experience of God, and that seems at times to be so alluring to us, so tempting to us as it comes at us in various forms. But Paul once again says, no, 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 no to that. Look at verse 19 and see how he responds. Look at verse 19 and see a growing body, as I've entitled it, in your outline. And that's taken directly again out of the text. Verse 19. Verse 18 gives us what they were doing, what they were pursuing. Verse 19 gives us what they should have been pursuing. Verse 19 says, what they're not doing is not holding fast to the head, from whom all the body, nourished and knit together by joints and ligaments, grows with the increase that is from God. That's what they weren't doing. Christ is presented here as the head, and also mention is made of the body, that is, the church. We see this sort of imagery used often in Paul's writings, often in the New Testament, and often in particular in Paul's writings in the New Testament. The picture of Christ as the head of the body, and the body being the church. Now, each time we see this picture presented, though, it is not always being used in exactly the same way. Sometimes he's talking about gifts. Sometimes Paul is talking about other things that he wants to instruct his readers, wants them to learn, and he latches on to and uses this image once again in order to illustrate for them, in order to help them to understand. So we have to be careful. It's not saying the same thing, though he uses the picture multiple times. It's not always being used in exactly the same way. So we ask ourselves, what is it in this text that Paul wants us to learn by his usage of this picture, this image, this metaphor of Christ as the head and we as the body? Well, here he talks about the head, I believe, in a very common way, not quite so common today, although we use it today in this way as well, but very common back in the first century. The word head also indicates source, source. And here, the head, quite simply, is the source of all that the body needs. Look at the text. From him, look at verse 19, the body is nourished. Now, don't put this to a 21st century physiological test here in terms of our knowledge of physiology. Understand it as a picture, an image that Paul is using. The head is the source, and Christ here is presented as the source of all that the body needs. From him, as I said a moment ago, the body is nourished. From him, the body is knit together. From him and by him, the body is able to grow. All of these things are because of Christ, because he is the head, because he is the source of all that we need to grow. In other words, apart from him, no nourishing takes place, no knitting together takes place, and no growth takes place. It does not take place through visions. It does not take place through a higher knowledge, a deeper experience that one person has. Rather, it is from Christ. Christ is the source. Christ is the source of growth for the body, for us. If you hear someone offering a higher, deeper knowledge, a higher, deeper experience of God, other than Christ, and other than his atoning work on the cross of Calvary, beware, beware, beware. Christ is sufficient. Christ alone is sufficient. Not Christ plus a deeper knowledge. Not Christ plus a deeper experience. But Christ plus nothing. The third and final warning comes to us in verses 20 through 22. And this one I've entitled, Not Rules. Not Christ plus the law or ritual. Not Christ plus a higher knowledge. And thirdly and finally now, in verses 20 through 22, not Christ plus rules and regulations. Verse 20, therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations? Back in chapter 2, verse 8, a number of weeks ago now, we encountered two of these terms back there. Basic principles of the world is back in chapter 2, verse 8. Let me read it for you. Beware lest anyone cheat you, once again, through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world. And now we flip back to the text before us this morning, chapter 2, verse 20. If you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations? And he goes on and identifies these regulations further on down at the end of verse 21 as according to the commandments and doctrines of men. Chapter 2, verse 8 had the traditions of men. Chapter 2, verse 22 has the commandments and doctrines of men. Chapter 2, verse 8 had the basic principles of the world. Chapter 2, verse 20 has the basic principles of the world. So we see this repeated here, what we talked about earlier. And at that time, I used these verses here in 20 through 22 to help us with that earlier text. What am I saying here? I'm saying here that once again, these words are difficult, maybe not so much to translate, but to understand, in particular, the basic principles of the world. And biblical scholars have a number of different ideas as to what's being referred to here. And we could debate this at length, what Paul is referring to here, and probably at the end of the day still not be absolutely certain. But nevertheless, what is very apparent to me at least, and I said this back in chapter 2, verse 8, and I say it again now, what is very apparent to me, and maybe this is just my simple mind here, but it's very apparent to me that in verses 20 through 22, he is indeed talking about asceticism. Asceticism. What is that? That's, as I said earlier, extreme and severe self-discipline. Discipline to the point of maybe beating your body, or discipline to the point of maybe being that monk, as I alluded to weeks ago, that monk sitting in a cave somewhere, wearing sackcloth or something like that. Extreme and severe discipline. And that's what Paul is warning us about as this third scam, as the third scam here. Now, don't misunderstand me. Don't misunderstand me when I talk about discipline in that way and discipline as a scam. Discipline is a good thing. It can be a very good thing. But discipline can be a bad thing as well. There's a reason why discipline and discipleship and disciple all have the same root. There is a good aspect to this idea of discipline. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul says the following about himself. Do you not know that those who run in a race, this is 9:24 through 27, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things, disciplined in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we, what? We do it. We are temperate, we exercise discipline, self-discipline, for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body, and I bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So why does Paul talk in this positive way, even using himself as an example of self-discipline here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and yet in Colossians chapter 2, he warns the Colossians of these false teachers who are coming up and coming to them and speaking of the need for this extreme self-discipline? What's the difference? Why the difference? Stay in 1 Corinthians 9 and back up just one verse to the preceding verse. And see, this is important, this is the key, see Paul's reason for pursuing and exercising self-discipline. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. Paul pursued this self-discipline. Paul pursued this self-discipline. In fact, earlier he talks about to reach those, just in the verses before, verse 23, in the preceding verses, he talks about, to reach those who are under the law, I become as one under the law. But he's doing all of this for the gospel's sake and for the sake of the ministry of the gospel. That's why he does it. Paul practices great self-discipline for the sake of the ministry of the gospel, that he not be drawn aside by these other things from the mission that God has set before him. But rather, instead of that, wrongful self-discipline is self-discipline pursued with the goal of obtaining righteousness through that self-discipline, obtaining righteousness and right standing before God. And to that, Paul says, no, no, no. Christ is sufficient. Christ alone is sufficient. Not Christ plus extreme self-discipline. Rather, Christ plus nothing. In conclusion, the appearance of wisdom. Verse 23. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion. Remember that smorgasbord we talked about a number of weeks ago, where we pick this and this and this and this to make up our spirituality, as is so often called these days? These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. As Paul says these words and writes these words in verse 23, I think he's really primarily addressing this third error, this third scam that is set before the Colossians. I think he's addressing that in particular, but it does stand well, actually, as a conclusion to the entire text, to all three scams, and I'm going to present it in that fashion, in conclusion here. Claims to extreme self-discipline, as we've just looked at, false humility, and the beating of the body, as it were, the neglect of the body, as Paul says in verse 23. But it also applies to these words that Paul has in verse 23, also applies to the idea of the rituals and the ceremonial law that he talked about earlier. And also, as he talked about between those two, the second one, this idea of a deeper knowledge, a higher knowledge, and a deeper experience. All of those things, Paul says here in verse 23, they all have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion. They all have, and this is something we need to carefully note, they all have an allure. They all have a draw. They all sound like a wise way to go. Even as Paul says here, they have the appearance of wisdom. Wow, that's profound. Wow, that's deep. Maybe that's the way I ought to pursue, or at least maybe that's something that needs to be tacked on to my belief and my faith in Christ. But Paul says these are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. What's the flesh? What did we talk about last week? He talked about that in the preceding verses. The flesh, as Paul refers to it here in Colossians at least, and many places, has that idea of our sin nature, that who we are deep down inside, who we essentially are, is a sinner. And Paul says here that these scams are just that. They're useless. They're of no value against the real problem, which is the problem of sin. We sang earlier, I didn't necessarily intend to say this, but when we sang, grace that is greater than all my sin, I don't think we sang this verse this morning. Let's see if I can remember it. Sin and despair, like the sea waves cold, threaten the soul with infinite loss. With infinite loss. The real problem is the sin problem. And Paul says here, that these scams are of no value against that. Previously, last week, Paul talked about the indulgence of the flesh. But he then went on to remind us that we are made alive, we as believers, are made alive in Him, with Him, in Christ. We are made alive in Him, in Christ alone. For remember, Christ is sufficient. Christ alone is sufficient. Not Christ plus rituals. Not Christ plus a higher knowledge or a deeper experience. Not Christ plus extreme self-discipline. But rather Christ plus nothing. Christ and Christ alone. Christ plus nothing. Let's pray.